Okay, let's talk about the unemployment numbers, which we have received this morning from the Department of Labor. This is described as an almost universally positive report, exceeding economists' expectations for the number of jobs created. And yet, the unemployment rate rose from 8.8% to 9%. Try to explain what's going on here. NPR business reporter Tamara Keith is in our studios once again. Tamara, good morning.
Good morning.
What happened?
Well, that's a little bit of a mystery. A lot of economists had thought that the unemployment rate had come down more quickly than it should, and that was a bit of a mystery. Well, now that it's rising, they can't exactly explain why. A very small part of it was that discouraged workers were returning to the workforce and starting to look again. They saw that things looked better. They said, let's go back. But actually, the total labor force only grew by 15,000 last month, which is a pretty small number.
Maybe we should just emphasize it's a little weirdness here. There's two different surveys,
yes,
right? And they come up with somewhat different results. They're surveys. It's not counting, literally counting every single person.
Right.
So
and
there's
a
margin for error.
And we've got a household survey and a payroll survey. They look at different things. And here's the thing. The payroll survey, that was impressive. That was very impressive and showed an incredibly strong report.
244,000 jobs created?
Actually, 268,000 in the private sector and then offset by government. But 268,000 private sector jobs created is the most single month private sector job creation in more than 5 years.
And wasn't there a thought that this would be a good deal worse than it turned out to be?
Indeed. Economists had been predicting maybe 175,000. Some were starting to say maybe 150,000 jobs created. You know, there were a lot of reasons for them to think that things might not look very good. The first quarter economic growth came in at only 1.8%. First-time claims for unemployment benefits, which are sort of a weekly gauge, had been coming in, rising almost all month. And then we got this private sector payroll report that also was weak. But then this government report came out and we're like, wow. I spoke to Jack Kleinhens. He's an economist at Case Western Reserve University. And he was one of a great many who underestimated the strength of this report.
I'm encouraged. I'd rather see a larger number, obviously, and I don't mind being wrong or being off, especially in light of this. But we've had a very unique recession. We're going to have a unique recovery. We're going to have a unique expansion.
Unique because it's been coming in fits and starts. But he says he's confident now, especially with this report, that the worst is behind us now.
Okay, so the unemployment rate is 9%, but something in the neighborhood of 250,000 more Americans are working or were working last month than the month before. So what else do you find in this unemployment report that's of interest?
Well, job growth was broad-based. Manufacturing continued to show strength. It was up 250,000 jobs over a little over a year. So that's massive expansion. Hiring was up in retail, leisure and recreation, healthcare, professional and business services. The one weak area in the private sector was construction, which has been weak for a long time because of the housing market.
Mm-hmm.
That aside, though, lots of good news. The number of long-term unemployed dropped significantly. A few months of other reports were revised upwards by 46,000 more jobs created, and hourly earnings increased slightly, too.
Only things really down, construction, and of course, government is down as well.
In fact, government was down 24,000.
Okay, just in a couple of seconds, are our economists pretty optimistic about the next few months?
You know, there are clouds on the horizon, the big cloud being $4 a gallon gas.
Okay. Tamara, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's NPR's Tamara Keith reporting this morning on the latest unemployment report. What we know is that unemployment, the rate rose to 9%, but the economy actually gained a net 244,000 jobs. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Mel Gibson's behavior has made him something of a pariah in Hollywood. But Jodie Foster, who co-starred with him in the 1994 film Maverick, cast him in the starring role of her new movie, The Beaver. Gibson plays a depressed man who talks to others only through a hand puppet. Foster plays his wife in addition to directing the film. David Edelstein has this review.
Every single person to whom I've mentioned The Beaver has announced that he or she has no intention of seeing another movie starring Mel Gibson, even if he's playing a nut job like they think he is in life. But I couldn't wait. I think Gibson is a fascinating actor, and he was especially good playing crazy in the 1997 thriller Conspiracy Theory, a welcome change from the usual make Mel mad template, where he's driven to take vengeance on those who kill or kidnap his wife or lover or child or dog. In The Beaver, Gibson plays Walter Black, a near catatonically despondent business owner who finds a beaver puppet in a dumpster and begins to talk through it using a blunt Cockney accent. Although Walter plainly manipulates the puppet and makes no ventriloquist-like attempt to conceal the movement of his own lips, the beaver claims to be alive and speaking on Walter's behalf. To engage Walter, you must literally talk to the hand. Walter even gives a letter of introduction to Meredith, his stricken wife, played by director Jodie Foster.
Hello. The person who handed you this card is under the care of a prescription puppet. Walter, what the hell is this?
Read the card.
Yes,
I... Read the card.
I...
Read the card.
The person who handed you this card is under the care of a prescription puppet. Designed to help create a psychological distance between himself and the negative aspects of his personality. Please treat him as you normally would, but address yourself to the puppet. Thank you.
There you go.
Is this some kind of a joke?
No, hardly, love. Nothing funny about it.
Stop it with the puppet. All right? I'm confused, Walter, and I need some answers right now.
Despite its bizarre trappings, Kyle Killen's script for The Beaver is rather tidy. It's a problem drama on the theme of defense mechanisms. Walter, through The Beaver, explains that instead of living in misery, he has wiped the slate clean and become someone else. In contrast, the movie presents his high school son, Porter, played by Anton Yelchin, who seeks to confront his own demons, most of them having to do with his father, and purge them in a way more conventionally psychotherapeutic. He's also made it his mission to force the girl he has a crush on, played by Jennifer Lawrence, to acknowledge the death of her older brother instead of repressing it. That doesn't prove to be the fastest way to a girl's heart, but neither, at the other extreme, is his father's planting a kiss on his wife's lips with a hand puppet. It's too bad that the beaver itself isn't much to look at, being an ordinary hand puppet with anatomically correct small eyes. Worse, what comes out of its mouth, or Walter's, isn't especially witty. You never see how Walter in the short term could be liberated by giving in to his aggressive and confident side, how he could actually have fun being madcap and filthy-minded. Gibson bites his lower lip as if chagrined and makes his face into a blank so that you register only his wounded blue eyes and sagging features. He abstracts himself. My guess is that Jodie Foster was so afraid of trivializing Walter's mental illness that she forgot she was an artist and not a social worker. Her pacing is so glum that the movie could have been directed by her character, Walter's troubled wife, a Meredith Black film. In the later scenes, Gibson begins to rebel against the beaver, which starts making like the demonic ventriloquist dummy in the old Anthony Hopkins thriller Magic. But even their grisly final confrontation doesn't liven the movie up much. I swear, the biggest laugh is when Walter makes the rounds of talk shows and ends up on Fresh Air opposite Terry Gross. I won't spoiler joke. I guess to hear it, you might have to be one of those people who goes to a Mel Gibson movie.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
President Obama flew to Fort Campbell, Kentucky today, where he met with members of Navy SEAL Team 6. That's the team that killed Osama bin Laden. It has been a momentous week for the president, the country, and the world, and it gives us a lot to talk about with our regular Friday political commentators, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Welcome back to you both.
Good to be with
you.
Does this action, do you think, change the public perception of President Obama, E.J.?
I think it changes it forever. It doesn't necessarily change everything in politics, but I don't think people will be able to see the president in the same way again. He showed the side of him, the inside of him, that is very cool, very tough, even hard, especially facing America's foes. It's also hard to imagine a better week that Barack Obama has had since he was elected president. He pursued this audacious plan, and that really deserves that word, against bin Laden, and he succeeded. He had those extraordinary moments in New York at Ground Zero with the firefighters, with the police officers, with the families of the people killed. Then you have these jobs numbers, which have some problems with them, but it's still a very large number of jobs created compared to what we've had. And then the Republicans are backing off their Medicare plan, and there are even signs, though who knows if they'll last, of oil prices going down.
And David Brooks, the killing of Osama bin Laden, political implications in the president's relations with Congress and extending into the 2012 election, what do you think?
I actually think minimal. I mean, I think it'll help him with a vague aura of authority, effectiveness, and competence, but it's not like this was sort of a central element of the Obama administration. I think it'll help people feel better about the country. It's been a long time since one of our institutions worked well. And the fact that the CIA and the military could pull this off and the president could make the decision will give people a vague sense or a better sense that the country is not totally on the wrong track. 70% think it will. I think the only area of concern for the president this week is, though, his personal approval skyrocketed this week. When you asked about his handling of the economy, that was either flat or down. And the odd thing is, even though we've had three consecutive months of 250,000 new jobs, people's opinion about the economy has plummeted in this time. And the question is people's feeling about the economy becoming a detached from these unemployment numbers because there are deeper structural problems?
We have seen the story of just what happened during the storming of that compound in Pakistan change significantly over the course of this week in accounts from top administration officials who first said that bin Laden was engaged in a firefight with the SEALs. Now the official account is that bin Laden was in fact not armed. He was may have been retreating when he was shot and killed. Was the White House, David Brooks, clumsy in laying out the details of what happened?
Yeah, I don't really blame them for this. I think, you know, they were enthusiastic. They'd had a great victory for the country, and there's always a fog of war. It has aroused the question, were we right to kill a man who was probably unarmed? And I think the clear answer is yes. If someone is a declared combatant against the United States, we're certainly in our rights to bomb him. And if we're in our rights to bomb him, we're in our rights to shoot him. And this was clearly a targeted assassination campaign. I think we were in our rights to do that.
A question, E.J., about how we describe the killing of Osama bin Laden. Here's the president announcing the news Sunday night. Let's listen.
We will be true to the values that make us who we are. And on nights like this one, we can say to those families who have lost loved ones to al-Qaeda's terror, justice has been done.
That choice of words, justice has been done. On Monday, I asked Susan Hirsch about that language. Her husband was among more than 200 people who were killed in the 1998 embassy bombings in Africa, orchestrated by Osama bin Laden. And I want to play you part of what she had to say about that notion of justice.
I think it's a common sense way of using the term justice. For me, I really think about justice as sort of our highest ideal, you know, the sort of best we can be is to bring about justice. And for me, justice is really far away from things that look vengeful or are presented as a kind of rough justice vigilantism.
E.J., I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the application of the use of justice in the killing of Osama bin Laden.
Well, that was an extraordinary, moving, and I think really magnanimous view there. You know, and I think that there is never anything like perfect justice in this world. I also think that the president is not given to language like "we took the guy out," so this measured language about what happened was sort of quite appropriate to him. I guess I'd say that, yes, there can never be any perfect justice, and nothing you ever do can make up for the killing of a single human being, let alone 3,000. But I do think if there was ever a justified killing, this was it. And I imagine that a lot of people who lost loved ones did, in fact, identify with that language that the president used.
There are a lot of voices in Congress right now, both Republicans and Democrats, saying that bin Laden's death means it's time to get out of Afghanistan after nearly 10 years of war. David Brooks, where do you come down on that?
Yeah, I actually don't see the relevance particularly. Bin Laden, as far as we know, was not central to a lot of what's going on with al-Qaeda. We know from some of the documents he had some tangential role. But al-Qaeda is not an organization like a normal corporation. We're very centralized. It's an extremely decentralized organization. And so getting rid of that one person doesn't really affect the extremely decentralized terror network he helped create, but which is off on its own.
E.J. Dionne?
I think the administration believes that this gives them the possibility of withdrawing more troops than they might have and negotiating some deal with the Taliban, because this undercuts al-Qaeda in a very serious way. And I think there is a sentiment in the country that would like to hope that the killing of bin Laden does mark the turning of a page on both wars that we're engaged in.
Okay, we'll have to stop there. Thanks to you both. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution, and David Brooks of the New York Times. These are challenging times for states trying to slash deficits. Today, Florida's legislature wraps up its annual budget session, and lawmakers there are setting some new spending priorities. NPR's Greg Allen reports from Miami on one budget line that's becoming less of a priority, the environment.
If you'd like to see federal tax dollars at work, drive west from Miami through the Everglades on Highway 41, the Tamiami Trail.
We've got all the pilings in, all the piers. We're starting to put decking on, and we're really excited.
Dan Kimball is the superintendent of Everglades National Park. What he's excited about is an $81 million project that will raise a road that for decades has acted like a dam, keeping water from flowing south through the Everglades. Despite the progress, though, a new threat has emerged to Everglades restoration. It can be found 500 miles away in Tallahassee, where Florida's governor and legislature are grappling with a $4 billion budget shortfall. As Governor Rick Scott says, the shortfall is forcing them to make tough choices in many areas, including protecting the environment.
We got to make sure we spend the money that we have and the property that we own. We got to take care of it as well as we can. Right now, it's a little harder because we're walking into a big budget deficit. You know, this job requires you to prioritize how you spend your money.
Scott, a Republican, ran for governor promising he'd operate the state like a business. Since taking office, he's made clear that his priority is to reduce taxes and regulations for industry, and one of the areas he's targeted for cuts is the environment. Following Scott's lead, Florida's Republican-controlled legislature is slashing some $30 million from Everglades restoration and eliminating funding for a number of other environmental programs, including a land conservation effort that's been in place for two decades. Those actions have led environmentalists to worry Florida is returning to its dark ages, when the state's beaches, water, and open land were viewed as commodities to be exploited.
This is a time capsule that we decided to put together.
At the Tropical Audubon Society headquarters in Miami, director Laura Reynolds unscrews the top from a large waterproof container. It's filled with pictures, letters, and artifacts placed inside for a purpose.
A lot of people in the community that work on environmental issues were so frustrated with what's going on in this state right now that we thought we needed to send a message to the future.
It's not just the cut in spending on environmental programs that has Reynolds and other activists upset. It's also a pro-business, anti-regulation agenda aimed at restraining the ability of the state and local governments to control growth and development. At Governor Scott's suggestion, the legislature has largely dismantled a state agency that for 25 years has served as a check on sprawl and runaway development. Kirk Fordham, head of the Everglades Foundation, has been working to convince legislators and the governor that dismantling regulations to help developers and the construction industry is short-sighted. He warns that loosening environmental protections may endanger the state's largest industry, tourism.
Well, that's really the backbone of our state's economy. We don't have a Silicon Valley. We don't have a steel or auto industry in Florida. Our economy is so intertwined with our natural resources and our environment that if we allow that to deteriorate, then we're really sacrificing our future economic growth.
Florida's former governor and three-term senator, Bob Graham, says he believes the state's elected leaders may be losing sight of some important core values, long defended by both political parties. In a recent op-ed piece published statewide, he called on politicians to reassess their plans to downgrade environmental protections.
The consequence of doing this is to go back to the era where we looked at Florida and just said, it's not really worth very much. If we don't like what it is, let's change it and let's put it on the auction block.
Despite the pleas of the former governor and others, Florida's legislature this week is finalizing a budget that reorders state priorities, one that puts protecting the environment behind the need to promote development and growth. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
A
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. The state of Indiana has approved one of the country's most extensive school voucher programs. Republican Governor Mitch Daniels signed the bill yesterday. He says vouchers will level the playing field for Indiana students.
It means social justice has come to Indiana education. It means that the ability to choose a school that a parent believes is best for their child's future is no longer limited to the wealthy.
As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, some are hoping this and other efforts will push vouchers into the educational mainstream.
The Indiana Voucher Program will take state support of private education into new territory, the middle class. These programs are typically only available to low-income or disabled students, but Ohio's plan will give some public support to families earning as much as $61,000 a year. Robert Enlow, head of the Foundation for Educational Choice, says this is just the start. He wants to see vouchers available for everyone, regardless of income.
So I think we should be looking at a system of education in America that funds the child wherever they want to go, regardless of the school system that we have in front of us.
That notion does not sit well with some who have crusaded for vouchers as a tool for addressing poverty.
I oppose universal vouchers. I always have, and I always will.
Howard Fuller used to be head of the Milwaukee schools, home to the nation's first voucher program. He now teaches at Marquette University. He is eyeing warily a proposal by another Republican governor, Scott Walker of Wisconsin. It would expand Milwaukee's existing voucher program to include higher income brackets.
Why did we fight for this? We didn't fight for this in order for people with means to get a voucher from the state. We fought for this because low-income and working-class people are the people who are forced to stay in schools that do not work for their children.
While some voucher supporters are taking aim at income limits, others are going after the numerical limits on many programs. Ohio Governor John Kasich wants to expand his state's plan from 14,000 to 56,000 students. Chester Finn of the Fordham Foundation, an education think tank, says families have been clamoring for these programs to grow.
Milwaukee's at capacity. Ohio is at capacity with its current program with these various limits on it. More people want in than are allowed in under the caps and the ceilings. Yeah, we're going to see some expansion for sure.
Jody Timmerman of Toledo, Ohio, has two of her three children in a parochial school thanks to what Ohio calls the Educational Choice Scholarship. She describes the public schools her children would have attended as large and scary.
And I know the classrooms are pretty crowded, but at St. Pius, they're not, so we're very happy about that. It's a smaller environment.
Researchers continue to argue over whether voucher programs boost achievement. The expansion underway may now give those analysts more information, since voucher programs have been relatively limited in size and isolated in pockets across the country. Washington, D.C.'s on-again, off-again program is being revived thanks to a vote in Congress. And Douglas County, Colorado, known for high-achieving schools, just authorized its first voucher program. Wendy Vogel, a parent in Highlands Ranch, Colorado, says the promise of a $4,500 voucher will just encourage people to go to private schools, even if their public schools are doing fine.
I think that it's going to be people who, okay, wow, now I can have a private school education mostly paid for or partially paid for, so I might as well do it.
Vogel points out that her county's voucher program comes as Colorado schools are facing huge budget cuts. That means each voucher student will exacerbate the shortfall by taking money away from public education. Concerns about costs are reining in the passion for vouchers in many areas, and most states still face constitutional prohibitions that bar the use of public funds for religious schools. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Short-term price swings shouldn't rattle investors like Joseph Deere. Deere is the chief investment officer of the California Public Employees Retirement System, CalPERS, as it's called. It's the country's biggest public pension fund. More than 1.5 million firefighters, policemen, and other public workers in the state depend on CalPERS for their health and retirement benefits. As chief investment officer, Deere is responsible for getting the best returns possible. We reached him to talk about CalPERS prospects. Mr. Deere, welcome.
Good morning.
First of all, CalPERS took a big hit, as did every big financial fund during the crisis. Your stocks, other investments, lost considerable value. Has CalPERS recovered?
We've come a long way back. Our
loss in fiscal 2009 was 24%, which is a huge hit to take, and our assets bottomed at $165 billion. We're closing on $240 billion now, and for the past 2 years, we've had double-digit returns.
Do you think that's going to be sustainable for public employees to get richer pensions than private sector workers are able to get in this kind of economy?
The shift around the public policy debate on pension benefits in the public sector is dramatic, and it's a lively issue in California and around the country. I'm an investor. I'm supposed to meet the financial obligations of the fund against obligations, promises, liabilities that already exist. When the policymakers make decisions about the benefits, then we'll adjust the portfolios to them. I think it's important for public sector plans to think more broadly. I also think it's important to have a realistic debate about the economic realities of these programs and the economic benefits they provide.
You have to be thinking that some of the states are looking at various kinds of changes in their retirement programs, and that cannot help but hit California as well. So you must have to plan.
Well, we have to plan in terms of understanding the liabilities. And if there were fundamental changes in the character of the benefit program, it would change the liabilities. But it wouldn't change the overall investment philosophy, which is how to get the best return at a reasonable level of risk, how to look forward, do a better job of risk management. Those challenges of investment management will exist regardless of the relative level of benefits. The debate in the United States really ought to center around what is retirement security, so that all Americans can have a time of leisure after a life of work where they can enjoy the fruits of their labor. And we are not accumulating enough in the U.S. now to make that promise a reality for all Americans. And that's a significant social issue.
Kelbers has been known for thinking globally, pulling investments out of South Africa early on, putting pressure on the apartheid government of South Africa. In the past, in the sort of boomy years, made investments in which you demanded things of the companies to change their ways in some sort of way. Do you think that that is something you can continue to do? Can you afford that kind of activism now?
We have to. It's even more important. I mean, one of the contributors to the financial crisis was poor governance of American corporations. So we've stepped up our corporate governance activity, and we were active in the debate that led to the passage of Dodd-Frank, the financial reform legislation, and we're watching the regulatory agencies that are implementing that act. If you are a long-term holder of company stock, you don't have the traditional exit of if you don't like the company, you sell the stock. We are a permanent owner, and that creates an obligation on our part to be actively engaged in the management of these companies. We've expanded that perspective into issues like the environment and through programs to invest in clean technologies and focus on our home state of California through initiatives to help business formation and regional economic development in California through the California Initiative and through real estate investments here. There are a lot of things that a long-term patient strategic investor can do to earn a good return, but also produce other additional consequential benefits.
Mr. Deere, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Linda. Thank you.